From the heart of The Ohio State University on the Oval, this is Voices of Excellence from the College of Arts and Sciences with your host, David Staley. Voices focuses on the innovative work being done by faculty and staff in the College of Arts and Sciences at The Ohio State University. From departments as wide-ranging as art, astronomy, chemistry and biochemistry, physics, emergent materials, mathematics, and languages, among many others, the college always has something great happening. Join us to find out what's new now.
I'm joined today over Zoom by Julie Gollum, who is an associate professor of psychology at the Ohio State University College of the Arts and Sciences. Her research explores the interactions between visual attention, memory, perception, and eye movements using human behavioral and computational cognitive neuroscience techniques. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Gollum.
Thank you for having me.
So is it fair to say that you study how our brains make sense of the world around us? Is that simplifying it too much, or does that sort of capture it?
I think that captures the gist of what we do and the common theme of research in our lab. I've always just been fascinated by the question of how our brains can make sense of the world around us. And in particular, how is it that we can construct such vivid, rich perceptual experiences when the input to our visual systems in particular is so simple and rudimentary? And so we get input into our visual systems that are just points of light that are hitting the retina in certain patterns. And from that, our eyes and then our brains are able to make sense of that input and make sense of those patterns to create these rich perceptual experiences and allow us to function in the world. So my specific research gets into, you know, different aspects of how it is that we do that. But that's how I would describe sort of the driving question of all the things that we do is how do we do that? How do we make sense of the world?
Does that mean you're interested in visual perception? Is that a way to phrase it?
Yes. So visual perception is definitely a main interest of mine. I'm interested in visual perception on its own, but also how visual perception interacts with attention and working memory and eye movements and other processes as well.
Just a moment ago, you described our visual system as simple. We use the word simple. What does that mean? What do you mean our visual system is simple?
So our visual system is far from simple. So our visual system, the eyes and the connections between how we get from our retina into the optic nerve and into the brain and then between the different parts of the brain is fascinatingly complex. But how that process begins, the basic sort of physical input that is received by our retina are just changes in wavelengths and magnitude of light. So it's patterns of light that are hitting the retina at different wavelengths is what creates color, but the different spatial patterns of light hitting the neurons in our retina are what triggers that whole complex process.
Well, I'm interested to learn about your research and the work of your lab, the Visual and Cognitive Neuroscience Lab. Tell us about some of the projects in which you're engaged.
Yeah, so we tackle this question of visual perception and the interaction of visual perception with all these other processes from a variety of angles. So some of our research uses techniques like studying human behavior and perception, sitting people in front of a computer monitor while they look at different tasks and they do basic computer-based tasks where we present things of different colors or shapes or locations in different parts of the screen and we look at how people perceive them and respond to them. And we also do a lot of those same tasks while collecting neuroimaging data. So collecting pictures of the brain with functional MRI or EEG electrodes on the scalp, sort of measuring neural activity as well. So we do a number of specific projects using these different techniques, basically just trying to get at what we perceive under different scenarios and how what we perceive might change based on what we're paying attention to or what we're remembering, things like that.
What sorts of conclusions have you drawn?
Yeah. So one of the things that we've found that we've been looking at in the lab is how we perceive things under different dynamic scenarios. So a lot of research that people have done on visual perception, for a variety of reasons, some practical and some theoretical, oversimplify scenarios in the lab. So we bring people in and, you know, they might involve someone just staring at a single fixation cross in the center of the screen. So we make sure we know where they're looking, and you present sort of single objects and you say, you know, what are they perceiving? And over time. But in the real world, you know, it's complicated. We don't just have a computer screen. You don't just have people looking in one particular place. And so a lot of the research that we've been doing lately has been focused on what I call more like dynamic visual attention and dynamic visual perception. So how does what we perceive in a given moment depend on not only what are we attending to right now, but maybe what were we just attending to prior to that? Or, you know, if we're making eye movements around the scene, eye movements are a really fascinating challenge, I think. You know, we get visual information in relative to our eyes. So the eyes and the retina are obviously, you know, vital for us being able to see and perceive. But our retinas are not uniform. So we have higher resolution at the fovea, the center of the retina. And so often if we want to focus in on things, we make eye movements around to help us highlight the most relevant information and get sort of higher resolution information. So we look directly at something. But one, that process happens and we're totally unaware of it, but we make multiple large eye movements every second. So multiple times a second, our eyes are constantly just moving all over the scene to explore it in the real world. The positive effect of that is we're able to focus in on different objects in the world at high resolution and sort of perceive many objects at high resolution. But there's this really interesting byproduct that happens as a result of that. And that's that our retinas also have a spatial bank of filter. So the neurons on the retina are aligned spatially, and that spatial organization, it's sometimes called retinotopic organization, it forms a map of the world on your retina, and then that spatial map gets preserved back through the thalamus and into the brain as well. And so we have sort of a spatial map of the world in our brain as well in the visual system. But every time you move your eyes, the position of stable objects in the world, you know, if I'm looking at a person and they're staying still, but I move my eyes to look at something else, the image of the person that I was looking at before is now hitting a different place on my retina. And so every time we move our eyes, not only are we processing something different in high resolution, but the locations of objects in the world are constantly shifting around on our retina. And so our brain has to compensate for this. With every eye movement we make, the brain has to sort of compensate and shift and remap that map around.
So you say we're making eye movements all the time. Is that happening to me right now? I mean, I thought I was sort of affixed on your face right now. Is that not what's actually happening?
So right now, it largely depends on focus. So if I'm, you know, really the most salient thing in your environment, you're probably looking at me most of the time, but you're also probably making eye movements around my face. You might be sort of looking back and forth between my eyes and my mouth. So you might be making smaller eye movements as well. But then, you know, you might be moving your eyes around a little bit to sort of check out the background of my scene, or maybe to look at my, you know, coffee mug or other things in the background. And certainly if it was a more distracting scene, or, you know, if there were lots of things around, we'd be making eye movements all the time.
Of course, as you say it now, I find myself doing it. So that must be the case. So how in your lab or in your experiments, how do you track eye movements? How does that work?
There's really great eye tracking equipment that we can use. And the most common way we do it in our lab is with an infrared eye tracker. So it's a camera. So when we sit people down in front of the computer monitor, just sort of in front of the computer monitor, there's a small camera. And alongside that camera is a bank of infrared lights. So just like a little circle of infrared lights that are illuminating, that are focused on the eye. And so the camera is a special camera that has an infrared filter on it. So it basically collects the reflection of that infrared light and the different parts of our eyes. So the pupil and the corneal reflection reflect back that infrared light. You calibrate the eye tracker. So the first thing, if someone comes in to participate in a study in our lab, is we'd sit down and first we turn the eye tracker on, we get it focused on their eye, and then we tell them, okay, look in this location, look in this location, and we sort of point around at different locations and tell them where to look, and we calibrate the eye tracker. And then once we've calibrated the eye tracker, they can look around in any position and we can sort of track where on the screen they're looking at any moment in time.
So you use the word attention. That means something specific to me. When you say attention, what is it that you're studying? What is it that you mean by that?
That is such a great question. Attention is one of those words. There's a famous quote by William James that starts, "Everyone knows what attention is." And yet it's really hard to define, because it turns out, you know, I study attention. I've been studying attention for decades now, and it's hard to come up with a single definition of attention, even though we all intuitively have a sense of what it means to attend. And one of the things that, you know, we and others have found is there are multiple different aspects of attention. So sometimes paying attention can mean being focused on something. So being in sort of a state where you're focusing attention on the task at hand and you're trying to ignore all the other stuff going on in the world around you. Sometimes attention can mean spatial things. So sort of what your eyes are moving to look at, or even without your eyes moving, just what you're paying attention to in the world. So sometimes it can refer to that selection mechanism. Sometimes attention can mean, you know, the things that you select. I mean, a fundamental principle of visual perception and attention is really this idea that there's too much out there in the world for us to process at one time. I mean, I think this is why we need attention and why attention is important. And so the world around us is incredibly complex, and our brains we can't process everything. It's simply not possible to process everything in front of you at any given time. So we have to select a subset of that information for processing by the brain and for perception. And so attention is operating all the time. Sometimes it's sort of unconscious attention that's happening, that you're not necessarily intentionally paying attention to some things, that some things just sort of capture your attention and they're more salient. That's what you pay attention to. Other times we exert control over it. So we might have certain goals and we pay attention to things that are consistent with our goals. But all of these have this common theme that we sort of need to select information to attend, and then that information that gets selected gets sort of prioritized and enhanced by the brain, and then that's what we perceive.
Well, maybe you've already sort of addressed this. Does this mean that attention is always sort of intentional or conscious? In other words, can there be sort of an unconscious attention?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a lot of different ways that people try to talk about the different types of attention. One common way that people try to differentiate these different types of attention is by talking about attention that can either be goal-directed. Sometimes that's called top-down attention. So that's the conscious, I want to listen to you, I want to pay attention to you, so I'm going to focus my attention on you. That's often contrasted with what's called sometimes stimulus-driven or bottom-up attention. And that's sort of an automatic capture of attention by salient things. So even if, you know, if I'm trying really hard to pay attention to you, this is my goal, this is the only thing I'm focused on, but, you know, suddenly one of my kids bursts through the door screaming, you know, no matter how focused I am on you, you know, our attention is going to be captured by that, or a fire alarm goes off in the distance. And so certain things that are very salient capture our attention automatically. And so that's a different mechanism of attention, this sort of low level, you know, automatic stimulus-driven attention. That's often contrasted with our goal-driven attention, the things we want to pay attention to. And then there are other types of attention too, like sometimes just our prior history biases our attention in certain things. So, you know, even if that's somewhere in between sort of that conscious and, you know, automatic attention, we're not really thinking about it, but maybe because I've learned things over time, I might be more likely to pay attention to certain things and ignore others. So there are lots of different types of attention. But yes, it can be both that goal-directed, intentional attention, but you can also have accidental attention, let's say.
Well, I know another interest of yours are perceptual errors, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about this research.
Definitely. And that actually ties in quite a bit to some of these different types of attention as well. So one of the things we've found, and that's been kind of a common theme of a lot of my research, is I've been looking at, you know, different types of challenges. So I talked about the eye movement challenge of how is it that, you know, we can perceive a stable world when we're constantly moving our eyes. And, you know, then we might also talk about these different types of attention. So another case is, you know, I'm trying to pay attention to one thing, but my attention gets automatically captured by something else, and how and what do we perceive in that sense. And I think, you know, a common theme of all of these is when we think about our perceptual experience, we have this sense that we're pretty good at it, that we perceive what's out there and that our brains are doing a pretty good job of it. And that, you know, we're not even, in the case of eye movements, you're not even aware that you're moving your eyes around. So we certainly don't see things sloshing all over the place and don't have the sense that we update, you know, and even when our attention is captured by something else, we're sort of aware that we're captured by something, you know, that we might temporarily shift our attention to something else, but we don't feel like the whole world, the perception of our world gets disrupted when we do that. We really have this sense that, you know, what we perceive is what's out there and what's stable. But one of the things we've sort of repeatedly uncovered in our research is that that's not actually true. And our brains are really complex, remarkable machines and organs, but they're not perfect. And, you know, there are some situations where our brains just don't quite get it right. And I think those are fascinating, those cases where we don't quite fully compensate for those challenges in the environment. And so when that happens, we end up with this sort of funky perceptual errors that we can reveal in the lab if we really focus in on it. And, you know, maybe in the real world, we learn to sort of ignore those occasional anomalies or, you know, suppress them. But in the lab, we can find these really interesting cases where people just perceive something totally different than what's actually there under these dynamic scenarios.
Give us an example of such an error.
Yeah, so one example, we were talking about the attention case. So I'll describe the experiment a little bit, maybe so you can get a sense of what it would be like. So let's say, you know, someone's sitting in front of the computer and we tell them, you know, okay, you're going to see some colored squares that are going to appear in different locations. And so we tell them, okay, you know, keep your eyes on the center. And just before the colored squares appear, you know, maybe when the colored squares appear, one of those colored squares is going to be outlined in white. So that's your target. That's the one I want you to pay attention to, the one in white. And then after they disappear, I'm going to put a color wheel up on the screen and I want you to click on that color wheel to tell me what color that square that you were paying attention to was. And so in that basic task, people do pretty well, even if we flash the colors really, really quickly. If they know which one they're supposed to attend to, they pay attention to, they can, with pretty small amounts of error, tell me, you know, what color it was that was inside that white square. But then if we do some of these more interesting cases, so we say same exact task, you know, whichever color is inside that white border, that's the color I want you to tell me. But then right around the time that those colors flash, we flash some distractor. So a couple of white circles appear in a different part on the screen, and maybe they're surrounding one of the other colors. So we'll call that a distractor. And so they're told, you know, just ignore that. Tell me the color that's in the white square. But if we do that, you know, we found on like almost a third sometimes of the trials that we do that, people make errors. And instead of reporting the color that was in that white square, sometimes they might report the color that was closest to that distractor. And so, you know, they might outright report the wrong color. And the crazy thing about that is when they outright report the wrong color and when it's because there was that distractor that captured their attention, we ask them afterwards, like, how confident they are in their responses. And they're just as confident as when they got it correct in those cases. So they don't even realize they're making those errors. They're reporting a completely wrong color. And they're like, no, I think I'm reporting the color at that correct location. And in other cases, we don't see that. So if they just happen to like be spacing out, you know, a different type of attention, and they just weren't paying attention when the colors appeared, and so they took a random guess, and they totally guessed the wrong color, they wouldn't be confident about it. We test that too, and they make a guess, and then they're like, I'm not really confident in that. And so we can see, you know, they do generally have some sense of when they make errors or not. But every once in a while, you know, when attention gets mixed up, and that sort of seems to be the common theme, you know, they're supposed to be paying attention to one thing, but their attention gets captured away to another location, and the brain doesn't quite keep up with that. So the brain sort of, you know, thinks you're paying attention to the thing you're supposed to, but really you were paying attention to something else that didn't fully get registered. And, you know, we see some of those sorts of errors after an eye movement as well. So if we present those colors right after an eye movement, we'll actually find all sorts of wonky errors there as well, where sometimes they'll sort of report a different color in the array, but sometimes they also do things like mix and blend the colors in the display. So if the color they were supposed to be reporting was blue, but the color that was sort of on the same place on the retina, the confusing location after an eye movement, is red, they might report a color that's a little more purplish blue. And again, they're not intentionally, they're not like, oh, I saw blue and purple and I'm not sure which one it was, so I'm going to blend them. It's just sort of something at the level of mixing up these features in the brain. And we think it has to do with attention. Attention really helps us resolve the world. And so, you know, if you're paying attention to one thing and you put your spatial attention on one thing, you can do something that's often called the binding problem. You can bind together the features at that location and you perceive something coherent. But what we've sort of found amongst these different scenarios of different types of eye movements and dynamic attention is that when your spatial attention is not stable, so if you happen to present those stimuli right at that moment in time when attention is kind of confused, in a sense, then your perception is confused as well. You know, there are a number of examples that we've sort of revealed these different types of errors. And we've also gone on to show that you can make different types of errors, these sort of large outright, like reporting the total wrong color error, or those more subtle sort of blends of color, you know, our features. And those characteristic types of errors we make under different situations. So you can sort of tell that, you know, when someone's dividing their attention across multiple things, you tend to get more of those mixing. Whereas if attention is like outright at the wrong location, then that's when you get those bigger errors. And so we can use that to sort of learn more about those attentional processes as well.
I've heard it said that eyewitness accounts are sometimes unreliable. Does that explain part of that? Is that true?
This is a fascinating question. Yes, that is true. And it's really interesting you bring it up. I teach an introduction to cognitive neuroscience class. You know, when I teach this class, I draw a parallel between, you know, when we talk about perception in the perception lectures, the idea that what you perceive is not necessarily what you see. You know, that there's a difference between what you perceive and what you see. And then the memory lectures, we say, you know, similarly, what you remember is not necessarily what happened. It's a parallel type of error. I mean, again, you know, they happen for somewhat different reasons, the memory errors and the perceptual errors. Certainly, if you have a perceptual error, you'll also have a memory error. So if you perceive something wrong in the first place, you're going to remember it the way you perceived it, because that's how your brain processed it. But there are other cases, like with eyewitness testimony, where you perceive something correctly at that point, but then over time, the memories get distorted. And, you know, so in my lab, we don't study those sort of long-term memory errors, though it's a fascinating area of research. We do a little bit with sort of shorter term working memory, and do find that some of these types of errors, you can get these distortions, not just at perception, but during working memory as well. And over the course of sort of maintaining information in memory, you can disrupt it as well. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, just overall as a theme, it's something that is, it's counterintuitive for people to grasp. I mean, I think in a sense, we're overconfident in both our memory and our perception. And that's like, you know, people often get into arguments and disagreements about this all the time too. Like, well, I saw this. Well, I saw this. Well, maybe you're both right. You know, maybe you perceived something slightly different than the other person. And so it's one of the most fascinating puzzles about the brain. I mean, I think that's probably why I got into this in the first place, was this realization probably when I was an undergrad, the what you perceive is not what you see. And that, you know, your perception is, it's unique to what you perceived at that moment in time. And two people looking at the same thing might not perceive the same exact thing, depending on what's going on in their brains at that moment in time. And so I think that whole concept of perception and memory both being imperfect, I think it's a really important thing to understand about our brains.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Ritter, Executive Dean and Vice Provost for The Ohio State University's College of Arts and Sciences. Did you know 16 of our programs are ranked in the top 25 in U.S. News and World Reports, with 9 of those 16 in the top 10? That's why we say that the College of Arts and Sciences is the intellectual and academic core of The Ohio State University. Learn more about the college at artsandsciences.osu.edu.
Tell me a little bit more about how you ended up in this field. You'd mentioned sort of undergraduate courses or something. Did you know since your undergraduate days you were going to study psychology, you were going to study the brain?
Not since early on. You know, I guess growing up, I actually had no idea that academia was a career, period. You know, I knew there were professors, obviously, but I didn't grow up with any adults that were in academia around me. And so I was always into STEM type things. That was before STEM was a buzzword. It would have been nice to have that term to latch onto what I was interested in. But I was like, I'm interested in math, sciencey stuff. And I really liked just sort of learning about things and figuring things out. And so I went to college not really knowing what I wanted to study, but knowing that it would probably be something math, sciencey, and, you know, and I started taking courses and I took a bunch of pre-med courses. And then I also stumbled into some psychology courses as well. And I definitely had a misperception of what psychology was before I started studying it. I mean, I probably had the perception of psychologists as, you know, oh, they're people like psychiatrists, you know, they might tell me, you know, what's wrong with someone, or can you read my mind, or, you know, social psychologists. And in reality, these are, you know, there's so many different areas of psychology. Mm-hmm. But the area of psychology that I'm in is the one that really links up and fuses with neuroscience and the study of the brain. And so cognitive psychology or cognitive neuroscience is sort of the subfield that I found myself stumbling into as I was taking these biology classes, but also the psychology classes. And really, you know, I took a sensation and perception class as an undergrad. And, you know, once I took that, that just sort of blew my mind, learning about all these processes and not just the visual system, but, you know, the visual system has one way of sort of taking that raw input and making perception, and the auditory system has a whole other set of mechanisms that it takes the auditory input and produces perception and all the different senses. And so I got hooked at that point and then got involved in research in a lab as an undergrad. And at that point, I think I was actually finally exposed to, oh, like, this is what research is like, and this is what a lab is like. And hey, you know, you could just continue to learn stuff and do research, you know, and get paid for it. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Do you have undergrads in your lab?
I do. Yeah. We have a mix of people at all sorts of stages of training. So we have ranging, we have undergrads in the lab. We have some post-baccalaureate students, so students that have graduated undergrad that are doing like a two-year research assistant lab manager, full-time position. We have PhD students in the lab, and we also have postdocs in the lab who are, have completed their PhD and are sort of doing more independent training. But yeah, we usually have about half a dozen undergrads in the lab at any given time.
What's it take for an undergraduate to make it into your lab? In other words, do you accept just any undergrad that's interested, or is there some sort of selection process?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, I can't take every undergrad who applies because we have a limited number of slots, and I want to make sure that every student who we do bring on is given enough attention and resources to succeed. But this is honestly one of the hardest parts of my job because there are just so many talented students here at Ohio State. So when students are interested in joining the lab, I typically just have them email me with some basic information and we go from there. I try to make these positions as accessible as possible. So there are no required courses or experience that anyone needs to have before joining the lab. The idea is that we teach you everything as part of the position. So mostly it's just looking for students who are really interested and motivated to put in the time to learn the research. So I try to take students from a variety of backgrounds and experience levels. It's great to get students earlier in their studies, because they can sometimes remain in lab for multiple semesters and years. And we have some students in the lab who began as first or second year students, and by the time they graduate, they're essentially doing research at the level of our grad students. So sometimes they're doing senior honors theses, even presenting with us at major conferences, or sometimes even being authors on journal publications. And that's always really fun to watch students progress into those more independent roles. You know, in terms of applying to the lab, some of these students apply to the lab already thinking they want a future career in this, but others join out of curiosity or simply just wanting to learn more about the possibilities. And we really encourage applications from these students as well, particularly students from underrepresented backgrounds. So students can get course credit at Ohio State for working in the labs for the time they spend in the lab, but we also do have a bit of funding available for undergraduates. So students who need to be working part-time don't have to choose between supporting themselves financially or having these research opportunities.
Tell us what's next for your research.
Yeah, so I've been talking a lot about our behavioral line of research. So the research we're looking at just the different perceptual errors that people make or what people perceive and how it is that we perceive a stable world in the midst of all these distractions and when it fails. There's a whole other wing of work in our lab. I mentioned earlier that we do a lot of neuroimaging research as well. So we are also interested not only in what people perceive and, you know, when do they make these errors and what kinds of errors or how do they perceive things correctly, but also what exactly is going on in the brain during these different tasks and what are the different brain mechanisms that support perception and attention and so forth. We do a lot in the lab with neuroimaging. Some of the stuff that we've been doing the past couple of years that I'm most excited about in terms of future directions is we've been spending a lot of time trying to develop some new computational analysis techniques for neuroimaging studies that add on to what people have done in the past. So there are some existing techniques out there that use machine learning often to try to analyze patterns of brain activity. So if you put someone in an fMRI machine and you're sort of taking a sequence of pictures of the brain.
fMRI?
Yes, sorry. So fMRI stands for a functional magnetic resonance imaging or functional MRI. Probably heard of MRI as, oh, if you get a knee injury, you go in and you get an MRI of your knee. It's the same technique, but there are some differences when we use it as functional MRI. So it's the same machine, but it's a different set of sequences. And the main differences between functional MRI and regular MRI. So regular MRI, if you were taking an MRI of the brain, we would use that to get a very high resolution anatomical image of the brain. So you'd get an image of like all the different parts of the brain at pretty good detail. So fMRI, it takes advantage of blood flow changes in the brain. We use it as an indirect measure of neural activity in the brain. Mm. So what we're measuring in a nutshell is sort of the magnetic properties of the blood through the brain. And it relies on this really cool idea that if one part of your brain is active, or more active, and then the neurons in your brain are going to be firing more, and those are more active, and their neurons, their cells in your body, they need more oxygen as they're active and more blood flow. And so blood flow increases to those parts of the brain that are active, and the blood flow that increases carries oxygen to and from those areas. And so there's a really interesting difference that you can actually, there are different magnetic properties for oxygenated blood versus deoxygenated blood. So this is sort of a longer version of saying that fMRI or functional MRI is a way of indirectly measuring neural activity in the brain. And we can tell what parts of the brain are more or less active at different points in time. And so you can stick someone in an MRI scanner and you can have them do these different tasks. And then we can get images where we can sort of look at the 3D view of the brain and look at changes in this neural activity over time as you do this. And so it's a really cool technique. We have a fabulous neuroimaging center here at Ohio State, so the Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Brain Sciences. It's right in the basement of our psychology building, and it's an amazing world-class center. It's one of the main draws for me coming to Ohio State. And so we have this fabulous neuroimaging center, and so we can collect data right here at Ohio State using this functional MRI machine. And so we can get these sort of images of the amount of brain activity in different bits of the brain over time. And then you can analyze that in a few different ways. One of the things that we're most excited about right now is using these different machine learning techniques to try to decode things into patterns of brain activity. And so can we tell from the pattern of brain activity at different points in time, what color someone was paying attention to or perceiving, or, you know, which object were they attending to or which location. And so one of the exciting things we've been doing in our lab is building on these techniques to try to refine them and get even better methods that we can use to, sometimes it's called decoding or reconstructing. So to try to reconstruct from the brain activity, either what someone was perceiving, but also maybe which of several things that they're perceiving are they paying attention to, or even once they disappear, what are they remembering? So what are they holding in working memory once things disappear? And so we can use these computational cognitive neuroscience techniques to try to reveal the contents of perception and attention and working memory. And so that's something I'm really excited that we've been working on in our lab. And we do that with functional MRI, but we can also use these same techniques with another neuroimaging approach called EEG, which is electroencephalography. And that's when you place electrodes on the scalp, and then you can record electrical activity from different parts of the brain. And EEG has really phenomenal temporal resolution, so we can tell like what's happening at a millisecond scale in the brain. And so we can sort of fuse together the information that's coming with the good temporal resolution of EEG and the better spatial resolution of fMRI and try to combine those to reconstruct, again, these contents and what's going on in the brain during these different types of tasks. We're in the process of working on those things, but that's one of the things I'm most excited about working on going forward.
Julie Gollum, thank you.
Voices from the Arts and Sciences is produced and recorded at the Ohio State University College of Arts and Sciences Technology Services Studio. Sound engineering by Paul Kotheimer, produced by Doug Dangler. I'm Ava Dale.